Hello and welcome to another episode of the Auto Trader Podcast. My name is Wandile Sishi.
And I'm George Mini.
And we have a super interesting show for you guys today. And like every single episode, I think it's best to just kick off with what happened this past weekend, which was the F1 and one of the greatest races, I think, ever.
What is wrong with Hamilton?
What is wrong with Hamilton? It's a good question. I never seem to find anything.
Who pitches up to a Grand Prix in a clown suit?
A fashionista, an icon, the voice of the future. You know, there's different titles that you can give, the stature that is Lewis Hamilton. What do you hate about his...
He looked like the circus act.
I think he looked fantastic. This is... one of the greatest, it's questionable. It's questionable, but,
What is that?
Look, I can't speak for him, but, he's got his own agenda.
Would you dress like that?
Personally not, but
he looks like he kicked a cabbage.
And the cabbage won. Yeah. Look, his fashion taste is questionable, but... that's not what matters. It's what happens on the track, which is more important. But did you watch the Silverstone Grand Prix?
Yeah, I did.
What did you think?
It was very interesting. Again, I think Leclerc got the butt end of the stick.
For sure.
My opinion, honestly, jokes aside with Hamilton and his dress sense, and, people can dress the way they want, it's fine.
Yeah.
My honest opinion is that I have less respect for science.
Than Leclerc, or just in general?
Just in general, because of his decision to win.
Why do you have less respect for him in that scenario?
Because he put himself above the team.
Yeah. But he's an F1 driver who is...
It doesn't matter. Still in play. What could have happened there is they could have got 1-2.
For sure.
Okay. And they didn't. They got 1-0. Because Leclerc came fourth.
Yes.
Okay.
Whereas the two people behind both drivers ended up being on the podium.
Yes. Mm. Now, what I think Ferrari, and I'm not sure, I haven't read whether this has been spoken about yet, but my sense from watching that race was on that starting grid, Ferrari knew that Sainz had the better tires, right?
Yeah.
And that he could quite easily keep Hamilton
and Perez
behind him.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they said keep a 10-car length behind Leclerc because they knew Leclerc wasn't fast enough on those tires, right? So all you do is defend. You use those tires to defend.
Mm. Get the 1-2 for the team.
Get the 1-2 for the team. Ferrari gets more constructors' points. Leclerc is the leading driver between the two in terms of points at the moment. It makes team sense.
Team sense, for sure.
Absolute team sense.
Yes.
I'm not so sure Ferrari's happy with him.
No, they're not. I don't know if you saw what happened after the race, but afterwards, the Leclerc side of the team didn't want to celebrate didn't want to celebrate with Sainz.
Yeah.
As a result of that. But at the same time, this is the first time that Sainz has won a race.
Doesn't matter.
I don't know.
It doesn't matter. He's not a team player. That's what he clearly said, is I am not a team player.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be emotional for anybody in that position. But I think from where he comes from, I'm not mad at what he did. I think it's important for him to make a statement that, I'm not just the secondary driver. And I also...
He is the secondary driver.
For now.
He got lucky with those tires.
Mm.
If you put him and Leclerc on the same tire in that race, Leclerc would have kicked his behind.
Once again, though, I don't trust Leclerc at all. I think he doesn't convert enough for me to give him the respect.
People finding me again. it's my sister.
I don't give him the respect that I think a lot of people do, just simply because he doesn't convert enough.
Leclerc.
Yes.
No, I mean, he's still a bit of a rookie in terms of... let me just tell this human that I'll phone them back. sorry about that. It's like everything, with Apple, everything rings.
And the watch, the works.
My watch is ringing, the iPad's ringing, the phone's ringing, and I bet you my laptop's ringing on the other side of the office there too. Anyway, I tend to agree with you that Leclerc is still a bit of a rookie, but I think he's better than Sainz.
Yeah.
In terms of, if you had to put the two drivers side by side, he outpaces Sainz every single time. Look at the qualifyings. Mm. Look at the race itself.
No, you're right. You're right there.
He keeps outpacing Sainz.
Yeah.
And I think Sainz made a mistake. He should not have done what he did.
Let's see what happens. I think the season's still gonna unfold. But additional to that race, I think we saw one of the greatest examples of car safety. So I don't know if you saw the scene, but this is sourced from the F1 channels on YouTube.
Let's have a look.
And this was basically the crash, and you can just see, you know, how far the cars have come since since F1 started. But it's incredible. Whoa. It's incredible to just see how.
Okay, safe so let's just can let's just look at what happened there. So yeah. When two tires touch each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can see.
So basically, Pierre Gasly was overtaking, was trying to overtake George Russell.
Yeah.
He clips George Russell's car and it spins into Zhou's car, Zhou Guanyu.
Yeah, Guanyu's car, but Russell's tire and Guanyu's tire, right? Mm. And it's either or, it doesn't really matter. Both tires are moving in a positive forward motion, right?
Yes.
Now, the tire that's behind is the one that's going to climb.
Yes.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
Because
it's climbing over the...
It's climbing over the one, and then the one that's in front is going to flick it even faster.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything...
That could have
changed that event.
Yeah, for sure.
There's no piece of safety that they're going to be able to put in place that's going to change two tires touching each other. Yeah. That was my point.
For sure.
So for me, it was horrific, but it just goes to show that the halos work.
For sure. And I think a lot of people are giving the halo the credits, and rightfully so.
You don't think so?
I think there's a few things there. There's also the I think it's called the Hans device, which basically stops the driver's head from becoming a blender, essentially.
Okay, just for everybody's benefit, where is the Hans device and how does it work?
So the Hans device is basically, it's attached to your helmets, and it basically locks you to your seat.
Okay.
So it's almost like a secondary seatbelt.
Well, you've seen those two clips on the side of the helmet.
Exactly.
Okay. And that's got straps to that device.
Yes.
And that device is attached to the car.
Yes.
And so it stops the driver's head.
It's a seatbelt for your
head. Seatbelt for your head.
Exactly. Yeah. So imagine if you're smashing into a wall at 55 Gs. Your body will stop the seatbelt. Well, seatbelts don't stop your body, but your head's still, you know, moving with that force.
Yeah.
So there's things like that have really kind of elevated and saved so many drivers' lives. But a lot of these devices are flying into modern cars. So it begs the question... Are all of these
flying into modern being installed?
Being installed in modern cars. So the question is, you know, are modern cars as safe to drive now because of these new, I don't want to say gimmicks, but these new safety features, which are increasing car prices? But what is the impact of that? So does your car have any safety features which are,
the impact?
does your car have any safety devices that, you know, 10 years ago, you know, you'd never see in the modern car?
So side impact bars, was something that wasn't in cars before. Crumple zones. So what you're trying to do, and this is, I'm a recreational pilot.
Yeah.
And what my flight instructor, actually the other day I went for a renewal test in my pilot's license. And one of the things my flight instructor always says is, if something happens, like you have the engine stops and you have to land, okay? Yeah. So remember, a plane continues to glide. It's just because the engine stops doesn't mean you have to fall out the sky, right? Yeah. The objective is to have the energy dissipate over a longer distance as possible, okay? So you want to come to a slow stop.
Mm. Kind of glide in instead of just falling in.
Yeah, you don't want to hit the ground and have a sudden stop, because it's not the crash that kills you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sudden stop that kills you.
Mm.
Your body just can't handle 55 Gs.
Yeah.
So So the point of all these safety features is to slow the impact on your body down.
Yeah. Increase the time of the accident, essentially.
Increase the time of the accident, exactly. Mm. Delay the time of the accident to your body and let the rest of the car absorb that energy. Side impact bars, crumple zones, so airbags other stuff
do
take,
exactly that.
Airbags do that. It kind of takes on the energy in your body moving forward.
Yeah.
And I suppose airbags are a big one. I mean, airbags have been around for a long time now.
For sure.
Things that are in my particular car, the Jaguar I-Pace, which suddenly catapulted most electric cars that are built in this way into a safety zone that no other petrol engine car can even rival.
Yeah.
And that is a internal combustion engine car has a big piece of metal inside the bonnet.
The engine. Yeah.
There's a big chunk of metal there.
Yeah.
That, you know, and the less something can crumple, the more it becomes a projectile.
Yeah.
So the moment you hit something, that engine is going to start moving
back
into the car. And an EV doesn't have that. The battery is literally under the car.
Yeah.
So it creates more crumple zone in the bonnet area. I suppose a Porsche is a very similar. I mean, I haven't looked at the Porsche's
any mid-engine car. Yeah,
could have a higher safety rating because you don't have that engine in the front.
Yeah.
So the crumple zones are more effective. So for me, one of the biggest safety features in EVs particularly is the fact that there's no engine in the front. Because I'm not sure that manufacturers of traditional ICE vehicles can solve for that problem.
Mm.
Airbags, yes. Crumple zones, yes. Maybe extending the distance between the driver and the actual engine block.
Yeah.
You know, making...
And those things are hard. It's not like something that can crumple for the most part. A lot of the parts are just... kind of
you can't
rigid.
It's like there's those the engine parts inside an ICE vehicle are rigid, so for me, to answer your question, modern safety, all of the things that are in cars today literally weren't there 15-20 years ago. I mean, the VW City Golf, the Beetle, Toyota Taz, those were incredibly dangerous cars.
Yeah. Just simply because these features were not there. I mean, my first car that I ever drove was a Toyota Taz, and it had no power steering, for instance.
Well, that's not a safety feature.
It's not a safety feature, but it's small things like that which really change the experience. And these safety features now, you know, change the experience of an impact or a crash.
Exactly.
And you know, it's the difference between sometimes life and death.
Think about this. Steering wheel.
Yeah.
Right? So you asked something that didn't exist 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Steering wheel, steering column.
Yeah.
Okay. So your steering wheel traditionally was attached to a pole, okay, which was attached to the rack and pinion.
Yeah.
You didn't know I knew what a rack and pinion was.
No, I do.
Which was attached to turn the wheels.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was a solid bar or a pipe.
That's just aimed at your head. Constantly.
That, you know, so what are the chances of that thing being a projectile?
Yeah.
Now with systems like drive-by-wire, where you do not have potentially this pole that extends through the car, you know. So modern cars and the electronics make for less rigid parts, I think, that are there to become projectiles.
Mm. Agreed. So there's actually been studies done on this, and essentially advanced driver assistance aids, they have reduced bodily injury by 27%, up to 27%, and claims have reduced by 19% since they've been around, which goes to show you just how much these help. I think one study said that 50,000 crashes could have been avoided as a result of this. 50,000.
Wow.
A year, which is...
In which country?
In the US.
In the US,
yes.
Okay.
The study was done in the US. But, I mean, that's a substantial amount as a result of these driver aids. So next time when you're buying a car, I think it's important to not see this as a an additional cost to the experience, but rather something that could potentially be the difference between.
I would say, you know, take safety features over entertainment aesthetic features.
Yeah.
You know, but people don't do that. People generally will go for something that looks nice rather than a safety feature in most instances. And people are very aesthetic human beings,
for sure.
By and large, they want a cool car. They want one that looks slick,
yeah.
You know, rather than one that can save your life.
One of the most impressive ones that I've seen, I think we have a video of it, is Volvo's braking system.
Mm.
So I don't know if you've ever seen the braking system on a truck.
Let's have a look.
Of how basically that, you know, could potentially save your life. And in this particular instance, I think it was a school bus. So the school bus had basically stopped on the side of the road, and kids were moving around about trying to get across the road. But now they can't see on their blind, the blind spot, because the bus was busy blocking the way. They couldn't see the truck coming. And it just basically saves this child's life who's trying to cross the road.
Let's have a look.
Quite simple. Just kind of read the situation there.
Did the truck do that or did the driver do that? Both.
Both were working in conjunction there. Basically, the truck could see before the human could, and he assisted in stopping the truck with the driver aids. But it's small things like that which you don't really take into consideration.
I mean, most cars today have emergency braking. My EV has emergency braking. Mm. So, and pretty much similar to what that was, where the car will slam on brakes for you.
Yes.
And it particularly works in my Jaguar when you're using the adaptive cruise control.
Yeah.
If a car slams on brakes in front of you, I've already had a situation where the car braked before I would have.
Because of the generative braking. Is that always on?
No.
Or is that
not because of the generative braking, because the car saw...
It's reading.
Yeah. The car read the vehicle in front of me.
Yeah.
Slamming on brakes before I read it.
Is the regenerative braking always on? Is how does that work?
In my car,
as soon as you're off the accelerator, it's already.
Well, when you're using adaptive cruise control, all of it's working together.
Yeah.
So regenerative braking is on all the time in the I-Pace. You can turn it to be lighter or heavier.
Yeah.
I've got it on maximum all the time.
Yeah.
Some EVs you can turn off totally.
Does that impact the what's it called? The range at all?
Yes.
Of course,
yes, of course it does. It doesn't recharge the batteries if you got it off.
Mm, true.
So regenerative braking by itself is not necessarily a safety feature.
No.
No. It's more to charge a battery
than anything else.
But the nice thing about regenerative braking is when you take your foot off the accelerator, you're immediately braking. Whereas I've always thought it in an ICE vehicle, it takes you a millisecond to move your foot from the accelerator to the brake pedal.
Yeah.
In an EV, that time is not there.
Because it's already slowing down.
It's already braking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these safety features are around. So the next time you buy a car, just check out what your car has, because it could be, you know, for peace of mind, I think it's important. Anyways, moving on. So I don't know if do you listen to music in your car?
Sometimes.
Yeah, what do you normally listen to?
Well, I mean, most of the time I listen to books or podcasts.
Yeah.
So very, very few and far between do I listen to music. Unless there's like a real, like really new song that I want to, you know, that I'm into. But most of the time I'm listening to podcasts or a book or
some audio.
I like talk radio, that kind
of thing. Yes, that's me. I love talk radio.
So I'm not a massive car music listener, if
that
means anything. But but if I was, if you follow a gentleman in South Africa, this you got to go get his book. Richard Sutton's books are absolutely amazing. He wrote a book called Stress Code.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm currently reading it.
I think you're currently reading it. Stress Code.
Yeah.
And part of de-stressing is actually listening to
music,
upbeat music.
Mm.
For at least, I think it's in the book, he says 15 minutes. If you listen to upbeat music, it actually activates what's called your vagus nerve.
Mm.
And so it's really a good de-stressor.
For sure.
So sometimes, you know, listening to music in the car, I like to do because of that.
Outside of what Richard Sisson says in the book, there have been additional studies to kind of substantiate that.
Mm.
But essentially, music can impact three things during driving: your mood, your performance, as well as your attention. Mm. So obviously, mood, depending on, you know, is it an upbeat song, is it a slow song, will impact how you're feeling when you're driving. With regards to attention, that's where I think it starts to blur the lines. So depending on the song, your attention could be deviated from just driving, because you're paying attention now as well to the song and to the lyrics. To the feeling.
I think it all stems from your mood. I stand to be corrected, but I read something years ago. They did a study in a gym.
Mm-hmm.
And they played different kinds of music, and then they observed the people in the gym.
Yeah, I can.
And when they played heavy metal and really like hard music,
yeah,
people started throwing the weights around.
Yeah.
In the gym, like dropping it on the floor. I mean, not being aggressive, but their behavior with the weights changed. Their relationship with the weights changed.
Yeah, they're just jacked up and pumped up right now.
Yeah, like throw the weight down and pick it up, and you know. So I definitely think attention would stem from mood, and music is a mood changer
for sure. And then performance is the last thing. So they did a test when this wasn't driving; it was people who were playing a driving video game. To see how the music impacts their lap times.
Mm.
And the faster the song was, the higher the tempo was, the worse they did. Just simply because their concentration is now focused on, you know, driving to the beats instead of kind of cruising. So the music that you play in your car does have a significant impact on, you know, your driving experience.
Yeah, I mean, listen, in Richard Sutton's examples, you've got to listen to upbeat music 15 minutes at a time. But there is also something to be said with calm music.
Mm.
Because the moment you calm down and you drop your heart rate,
I fall asleep.
Well, no, besides falling asleep, you're able to take in more of your environment.
Okay.
Because your peripheral opens up, you start to notice things around you because you almost slow down.
Yeah.
So I would say there's benefits to both upbeat music and calm music.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not suggesting listen to Beethoven, but
unless you're into that. But essentially, I think to summarize that, the safest tempo is between 60 and 80. So that's kind of the safe zone between I'm not falling asleep and I'm not super jacked up on, you know, this dubstep that I'm listening to.
It's interesting that it's between 60 and 80 because your resting heart rate
around there
is around that.
Exactly. And that's exactly
tempo.
Why.
Yeah.
It's kind of your most concentrated tempo is around there.
Well, so it synchronizes, I suppose, with your body then.
And that's exactly why, you know.
So I suppose under 60, that's the sleep zone.
There's a few songs that have been spotlighted for that.
I don't like listening to depressing music. It doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah. There's a few songs on the list which have been suggested, such as Cry Me a River by Justin Timberlake. Everyone loves that song, so listen to that. And there's some Drake on there as well. But maybe in the description we'll just post that those top 20 best or safest songs to listen to
within that tempo.
Within that tempo.
Interesting. I want to go and make a playlist out of this and see.
And see how it impacts your driving.
Well, no. I want to see how it impacts my driving because I suppose you won't know what you won't know.
Yeah, true.
You've got to be observed from the outside.
Exactly. Well, we're running out of time, but before we leave, so something that's quite topical right now is load shedding. So I wanted to know with regards to load shedding. You're an EV driver. So I wanted to find out basically how load shedding has impacted your driving experience. And I think the first thing I want to know is, has there, you know, even been an impact on your driving experience as a result?
So no, it has had zero impact on my driving experience. And I think I know what you mean, but you know, driving the car during load shedding is, you know,
let's not necessarily the driving experience, but the ownership of an EV vehicle.
I get you. Mm. So yes and no.
Yeah.
It's winter, right? Yeah. So what I have noticed in my solar installation in my house is the photovoltaic panels reduce their output by up to between 20 and 40%.
As a result of
being
cold?
As a result of winter.
Okay.
I haven't dug into the reasons why, but as a result of it being cold.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. I have the ability to generate roughly 20 kilowatts out of the panels.
Yeah.
Probably 18 if, you know, on a really hot, sunny summer's day. That's the capability of those panels. Right now in winter, the maximum I've seen it go to is 7 to 8 kilowatts of output. Okay. So now I'm not generating as much electricity from the panels as I was in summer.
Yeah.
That does impact my ability to charge the car using the solar panels, because now the solar panels are running the house, charging the house's batteries.
Mm.
So that's the first thing is if you're off the grid or you think you're off the grid from a solar point of view, your situation will change in winter. So that's the first thing. Now, let's take the solar installation out of the picture and just think about Eskom.
Right?
So I haven't had a situation where I haven't been able to drive my car in the day because I don't have enough battery charge available. Even with 4 hours of load shedding, my car only needs approximately 2 hours of charge per day.
Mm. Just because it's never on zero, right?
It's never on zero. I mean, even if you don't get to charge, there was about this week, there were 2 days that I didn't put my car on charge.
And you still managed to get through the week without a hiccup.
I came to the office this morning, and I think my car is on about 50% charge.
Mm.
And that's fine. When I go home tonight, I'll stick it back on, and probably needs about 5 hours to charge it up, 5-6 hours to charge it up to 100.
Mm.
If I get 2 or 3 hours of charge tonight, it'll get up to 70 or 80, even during load shedding. So even with 4 hours of load shedding twice a day, that's 8 hours.
Yeah.
You've still got the balance of the day. And
it's kind of charge, yeah.
You know, we're not having load shedding between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. constantly.
Yeah.
It's only off for approximately 4 hours during that time.
At max, yeah. Well, during the stages that we're currently experiencing, yeah.
So then you've got another, 8 hours left.
Yeah.
And you only need 2 or 3 hours of charge.
Okay.
In order to drive your EV. And that's what people miss, is you don't need as much charge time as you think you need.
Yeah.
Unless you're plugging into a 3-pin socket, which only charges at 3 point something kilowatts per hour.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got a wall box that charges at 7 or 11 kilowatts, it charges the car a lot faster.
Mm. Okay, so really no real impact.
No.
Your life's kind of adjusted. Just like this morning, I actually didn't realize that I was load shedding. I'm just so used to it now that I kind of just woke up, grabbed my water, and I left. And I realized only when I hit the robots that, oh, we're load shedding right now.
Well, I mean, I think, very, very finally, that Eskom is now forcing a situation where microgrids are going to occur more and more. People are going to go off the grid or as much off the grid as they can with a solar installation, from a solar installation point of view. And that doesn't bode well for Eskom, because they will lose revenue.
Yeah.
And the moment they lose revenue, the next thing is they might put up the prices.
Yeah.
Right. When they put up the prices, they will force more people to go microgrid solo. You know,
it's a cycle, yeah. A vicious cycle.
Well, it's called the death spiral.
Mm. Eventually, what happens then?
I don't think the government will allow Eskom to fail, hopefully, because we need Eskom.
Yeah.
I've got an off-grid system at home, and I've still now, because of the reduction in winter, because of load shedding, I have to use Eskom to charge my car some of the time.
Let's see what happens. But, hopefully it doesn't get to that point. That's pretty much all the time we have. Thank you, George.
Been good.
Yeah.
Go to Leclerc.